Welcome to the deep dive. So what we're trying to do today is sift through a whole stack of recent sources. We've got news reports, expert takes, direct statements.
Right.
And our goal really is to pull out the most important bits for you, cut through some of the noise on these pretty complex, sometimes surprising developments, give you that shortcut to being well informed.
Exactly. And these sources, they really give you a fascinating look at how different things connect, you know, high-level decisions, ground-level policy fights, and how it all ripples out.
Yeah.
We want to help you connect those dots. So it's not just what's happening, but, you know, why it matters, why it's important for everyone.
Okay, so let's get into it. First up, there's this pattern showing up in the sources President Trump's use of the 2-week deadline. CNN even cut together a video about it.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Like right now, he's apparently given himself 2 weeks on whether to attack Iran.
Yeah.
And we've seen this timeline before, haven't we, with Russia and Ukraine. There were statements, what, April 27th, May 19th, May 28th, always pushing things out about 2 weeks. But then, you know, nearly a month later, no peace deal materialized.
Right.
So what do these repeated deadlines actually signal? Is it just a habit? Or is there something more sort of strategic going on?
Well, that's a really good question. And the sources, they kind of offer different views. I mean, yeah, the deadlines often pass, but just making the statement, that raises questions. Caroline Leavitt, speaking for Trump, she actually defends it. It says he's the peacemaker in chief, interested in diplomacy. She called him a peace through strength president.
Interesting phrasing.
And she pointed out that Russia and Ukraine did have direct talks for the first time in years, right after one of those 2-week statements. So the argument is maybe the tactic itself gets talks going, keeps the lines open.
So it's less about hitting the deadline, more about the declaration itself as a diplomatic move.
Huh. Okay. That
Yeah.
seems to be the spin. Yeah.
Well, speaking of communication styles, our sources also picked up on this critique from maybe an unexpected place. Stephen Colbert.
Oh, what's he saying?
He's apparently sort of lamenting a decline in the quality of Trump's put-downs, his nicknames.
Seriously.
Yeah, he called the nickname too late for Jerome Powell, the Fed chair. Half a D. Said it wasn't up there with the greatest hits like, you know, Meatball Ron or Sloppy Steve or Little Marco. I
Okay.
remember Rubio's comeback to Little Marco, the whole thing about hand size,
Oh, yeah, that was a moment.
which Trump denied, of course. So even political insults get reviewed now, apparently.
Well, and that's kind of where the sources pivot to something more serious than just, you know, nickname quality.
Right.
You have figures like California Governor Gavin Newsom pointing to what they see as more significant cognitive fumbles.
Okay, like what specifically?
Newsom flat out claims Trump made up details about a phone call they had about deploying the National Guard in LA. Newsom said Trump lied, and then it added he might actually believe he said those things and he's not all there.
Wow, that's a direct accusation.
It is, and it forces you to think about, okay, where's the line between political talk, strategic communication, and, well, potential cognitive issues impacting how things are relayed?
And the sources list other examples too, like Trump confusing the Declaration of Independence with the Civil War,
Yeah.
apparently off by about 100 years,
Right. That one got attention.
and misusing idioms calling Biden not the sharpest bulb. That's not quite the saying, is it?
Not exactly, no.
Then there's the story about him struggling with Les Miserables characters, Jean Valjean or Javert, and asking Melania for help.
That was reported.
And maybe more startling, resharing that QAnon post claiming Biden was executed and replaced by clones.
Yeah, that was definitely out there.
Plus just the visual things people notice, like almost falling on the stairs to Air Force One, it all feeds into this broader narrative.
And there's analysis on this too. Dr. Jennifer Marcica, she's a communications professor, talks about Trump's communication showing a lack of focus. She suggests cognitive decline, describes his brain as not well disciplined, leading to these random digressions.
Okay.
She notes he brands himself as a truth teller, just saying what's on his mind, but the result can be really hard to follow. And Newsom doubles down on this, saying Trump's private conversations are even more concerning than the public stuff. Would send shivers up your spine, he said.
That's quite a statement. So how does all this communication style stuff, whether it's strategy or something else,
Yeah.
how does it actually play out in governing?
Well, Newsom's argument is that Trump's policies end up having the form and substance of fog, that they change on a whim.
A whim, based on what?
Based on who he talked to last, apparently, or how the audience reacts, or even, Newsom suggested, how Sean Hannity is feeling that day, which, you know, would make governing incredibly unpredictable.
Yeah, I can imagine. Newsom had some pretty colorful descriptions too, didn't he?
He did. Called him a music man, a carny, flim-flammer bullshit artist. It's harsh, definitely, but it points to this idea of policy being very fluid, potentially unstable.
Right.
But what's maybe most striking, and the sources highlight this, is that even people you'd consider core members of the Magrae family, like Steve Bannon, Tucker Carlson, are reportedly starting to question his capacity to lead right now.
Really? From inside that circle?
That's what's being reported. It's not just the usual political opposition. It suggests maybe a deeper concern is bubbling up, even among his loyalists. Apprehension about his stability, perhaps.
Wow. Okay, that is significant. Let's shift gears a bit. The sources also reveal a different kind of conflict, this one inside the government. An intra-governmental civil war, some are calling it.
You mean the Polte versus Powell fight?
Exactly. Bill Polte, the Trump-appointed head of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, versus Jerome Powell at the Federal Reserve. Over interest rates. It's a really public spat.
Oh, it's definitely public. Polte's been hitting X, you know, Twitter hard. He's using his role as chair of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to demand Powell cut rates or resign.
What's his argument?
He claims Powell is hurting Americans and hurting the mortgage market. And Trump jumped in, too, calling Powell too late, the worst, a dummy, even one of the dumbest, most destructive people in government.
Strong words.
Yeah, blaming him for billions in costs, comparing U.S. rates unfavorably to Europe's cuts.
And just to remind everyone, Powell was first picked by Trump back in 2017.
Right.
But then Biden renominated him in 2022.
Yeah.
Polte, though, he just got confirmed as FHFA director in March and pretty much immediately ousted board members and made himself chairman at Fannie and Freddie. Seems like he came in with an agenda.
Definitely looks that way.
Claw.
Now, Powell's counterargument, according to the sources, is based on economics. The Fed held rates steady partly to see the effects of Trump's tariffs.
Okay.
Which Powell had warned could push inflation higher. So this whole fight, it really brings up that big question about the Fed's independence, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
If a president tries to force out a Fed chair, that could really shake market stability, undermine the Fed's non-political role. And that affects everyone's wallets, you know.
Yeah, that's a critical point.
Yeah.
Huge potential consequences. Okay, moving to another big domestic policy fight. Senator Mike Lee's proposal, selling off millions of acres of public land.
Mm-hmm.
His plan mandates selling, what, between 2.2 and 3.3 million acres, BLML land, Forest Service land out west. He says it's about affordable housing, and he's clear it excludes national parks, monuments, wilderness areas.
Right. He makes that distinction. But what's really interesting is the pushback, and it's coming from both sides of the aisle.
Oh, like who?
Well, you've got Democrats like Senator Martin Heinrich from New Mexico saying he's skeptical it would actually help housing much, and he's worried about losing public access.
Okay. That's maybe expected.
But then you have Republican Congressman Ryan Zinke from Montana, former Interior Secretary under Trump, remember saying flat out, I will not support a bill that sells public lands.
Wow. Zinke saying that.
Exactly. And there was that whole flap over the mat from the Wilderness Society claiming 250 million acres were potentially up for grabs. Lee disputed that, said the map was inaccurate, but it definitely fueled the controversy.
And the criticism wasn't just bipartisan. It came from within conservative circles, too, right?
Oh, strongly. Sources quote fellow conservatives calling it a betrayal of the American people, saying things like, nothing more conservative than conserving our public lands.
That's pretty direct.
Yeah. Lee's defense was to blame falsehoods being circulated by the left. But it clearly hit a nerve, even within his own party, about what conservation means to conservatives.
It seems so. Okay, so speaking of land and resources, let's turn to the Texas Border Wall Program, which the sources say has sort of quietly been defunded by state lawmakers.
Yeah, that's a significant shift, especially when you consider they've spent over $3 billion on it.
$3 billion. And how much wall did they actually build?
Only about 8% of what they identified needing. So 65 miles built out of a planned 805 miles.
Hmm. Only 65 miles for $3 billion. And now they're defunding it. What's the reasoning?
The state's new line is basically that building the wall should have always been a function of the federal government.
Passing the buck, maybe?
Feels a bit like that. The money that was for the wall is now going to Operation Lone Star. That's the state's big border security push using DPS troopers and the National Guard for migrant arrests.
Okay, so a shift in strategy. How does that 65 miles compare to, say, the federal effort under Trump.
Well, interestingly, the Trump administration built only 21 miles of new wall in Texas during his term. So the state actually managed about three times that in 4 years, even with all the issues.
There were issues, right?
Big ones. The sources point out the state wall is really fragmented, lots of gaps, mostly built in rural areas where it might be less effective, and huge resistance from landowners.
Right, I remember that.
The Texas legislature actually banned using eminent domain for the state wall. And by March of this year, about a quarter of the landowners they approached had a refused access.
That makes it tough. Didn't Governor Abbott try crowdfunding too?
He did. Raised over $55 million, actually. But the link for donations, it's gone now.
Interesting. And all this is happening while border crossings have actually gone down since late last year.
Correct. Which leads some lawmakers, even Republicans, according to the sources, to question the whole wall strategy, its effectiveness, the cost. One compared it to being stuck on a hamster wheel.
Yeah, you can see why they might feel that way.
Definitely raises questions about resource allocation.
Okay, now let's turn to a different kind of domestic issue, but one that raises fundamental questions about authority and transparency. It's this practice of IC agents, immigration, and customs enforcement covering their faces on duty with no visible ID.
Yeah, this has drawn sharp criticism. Some sources describe it as un-American, even suggesting it hints at an encroaching police state.
Because the idea is that law enforcement should be accountable, right? Identifiable.
Exactly. That's the core principle. Police accountability relies on the public knowing who they are, which led California to introduce this No Secret Police Act.
Who's behind that?
State Senators Scott Wiener and Jesse Areguin. It's seen mostly as a statement, a necessary, if symbolic, rebuke, because its actual power over federal agents, like ICE, is debatable.
Mm-hmm. Although, didn't Fox News host Will Cain criticize it?
He did, yeah. He mischaracterized it, claimed it would put officers' lives at risk, which the bill's supporters denied.
So what's the deeper context here?
Stuart Schrader, he's a professor at Johns Hopkins, gives some interesting perspective. He connects it back to the Cold War, where the U.S. positioned itself as having this liberal tradition, unlike fascist regimes, with their unified, secretive, unaccountable police forces.
Right.
And Schrader completely dismisses the argument that the masks are for agent safety. He calls it completely preposterous, points out, you know, hundreds of thousands of police officers work every day without masks.
So what does he think is the real reason?
He argues it's really about destroying any possibility of public accountability. And about shifting the whole political culture toward intimidation, fear, and lack of accountability. It's a pretty stark warning about what this practice could mean for democratic norms.
It really is. Okay, final area. Let's shift to the international stage. Yeah. Russia's reaction to talk about potentially assassinating Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yeah, Moscow's reaction was described as very negative. This came after President Trump publicly floated assassination as an option on the table, although he added, not for now.
What did Russia actually say?
Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin spokesperson, issued a pretty blunt warning. He said any attempt at regime change in Tehran or threats against its leadership would open Pandora's box.
Pandora's box, meaning what?
Meaning it would just deepen instability, promote extremism across the region. And you have to remember the context. Russia and Iran have this growing strategic partnership. Iran's supplying drones, missiles for Russia's war in Ukraine.
Right, they're allies now, essentially.
So Moscow has a vested interest in stability there on their terms. Peskov's warning highlights how interconnected these conflicts are and how drastic actions could have really unpredictable global consequences.
And didn't Trump also recently dismiss Putin's offer to mediate between Israel and Iran?
He did. Told Putin basically to mediate your own conflict, meaning Ukraine. Shows you the complex web of tensions there.
Mm-hmm. And just to bring it up to the present, the sources also touch on the recent escalation, right, since mid-June.
Yeah. Israeli airstrikes hitting Iranian nuclear sites and commanders starting around June 13th. Then Iran retaliated with missile strikes on Tel Aviv.
And there were reports of civilian casualties in Iran.
Yes, an unverified claim, but reports mention at least 224 Iranian civilians killed around June 16th. Just adds another tragic layer to this very tense situation.
So, okay, we've covered a lot of ground here, just reflecting on it. The sheer amount, the complexity.
Yeah.
Presidential rhetoric, cognitive questions, internal admin fights, land policy battles, border security shifts, accountability issues, huge international tensions.
It's a lot. It really is. And the connections between all these things, they're not always obvious, but they're definitely there.
Yeah.
And maybe that leads to a final thought for you, the listener, to sort of chew on. In this time when we're swimming in information, but real clarity feels scarce.
Yeah.
How much do these leadership styles, even small things like communication quirks or internal fights over policy, how much do they genuinely shape everything domestically, internationally? What's the real cost, the real impact of unpredictability, of shifting narratives when the stakes feel so incredibly high? How do we as citizens trying to stay informed make sense of it all?
That's a great question to leave things on. Keep asking those questions. Keep digging into how these seemingly separate events connect.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.